So the lesson is on Psalm 32, and the title of the lesson is The Blessed Forgiven Man. And the title of the lesson obviously comes from the first couple of verses, where it says, the blessed man is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered, whose iniquity God will not take into account, and whose spirit there is no deceit. And this is a particularly critical psalm. So some psalms have New Testament quotations where the importance of that psalm is emphasized in a context where it's speaking of either a prophecy that is very central to Jesus' identity or an aspect of faith that really is fundamental, like a building block of faith. So Psalm 32, 1 and 2 is quoted in Romans chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. And really the idea of the quotation in that context in Romans chapter 4 is what's expressed in this psalm by David about how he sees the resolution of his sin with God, his attitude about his sin, the responsibility that he takes with his sin, the way that he sees God's forgiveness. That although David expressed these things in the Old Testament, that really the ideas of this psalm and the attitude David has in this psalm speak to something completely fundamental and transcendent about the faith that we also need to have in principle in terms of our attitude about God's forgiveness, our attitude about being guilty, our attitude towards resolving the problem of sin. So that's all to say that the quotation in Romans 4 seems to point to the fact that the attitude expressed in this psalm is very critical for us to have as well in our attitude. And we'll mention some more unique qualities about this psalm as we go on through the lesson. But I want to start in verses 1 and 2, and we're going to start with looking at the blessed condition expressed in the first two verses and kind of thinking about some practical points to be made from how this psalm begins. So verses 1 and 2 again, this is a psalm of David, and it's a maskil. Verse 1, how blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man whose iniquity Yahweh will not take into account, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. The thing overall here, something to, I think, maybe summarize the idea here, is what David is doing is he's basking in the blessed condition of being forgiven by God. And he's basking in the blessed condition of a person who does not have a deceptive spirit, meaning they're obviously someone who is honest, thoroughly honest with the Lord, right? And I want you to think, is David, when he's talking about how blessed is the man, what is he talking about? Like this term blessed, is he meaning something like how you feel when you're having a really good day? Is he talking about something subjective, like you eat a really good meal and you feel so blessed because your stomach is full and you had some food that you really enjoyed? I would argue that David is talking about something objective here, not subjective. Meaning that David is more considering a status than he is something like an emotion or circumstance. So by status, I mean, if somebody is single or married, that's not subjective. They are objectively, their status is they are single, or their status is they are married. And the idea of being blessed here, there's somebody that my parents were friends with. Really, they were a family friend when I was younger. My family in this time of life, we were very poor. We were recovering from bankruptcy, and my parents knew a brother in Christ that we were friends with where he was a CEO of a company, particularly a company that created and distributed airplane parts. So he was very, very wealthy. So he was objectively wealthy, but this brother, he would talk about himself like he was poor, right? And that was something that my family thought was kind of weird and funny, is him and his wife, you know, they would talk about themselves as if like they didn't really have, you know, money to spend and things were kind of tight. And we knew that wasn't really true. They were just being really, really modest, you know? So, you know, there's a time when a person's status is not something, you know, to personally think too much about or to boast in, but this isn't like that. What David is doing is he's basking in this, right? This is a status that is objective that needs to be thought about, it needs to be considered and reflected on. And what he means by blessed, I kind of want to illustrate with that same situation. If somebody is objectively wealthy, wealthy is a word, but there's a lot that's implied by that status. And it's even same with being married, having the status of married. To be married is a term, it's a word, but there's a lot that's implied. There's a lot of blessings or responsibility implied by the status of being married. And again, it's the same with this blessed person who's forgiven. It's not just that they are forgiven, it is what is implied by the fact that they are forgiven. It's what's implied by the fact that God is not taking into account this person's iniquity. There's implications of that status that are really the true blessing of having that condition before God. And kind of as we go into this, I want you to think, does the presence of God in your life make you feel guilty or liberated and joyful? Because again, this is something that David is being very purposeful to reflect on and consider. And the reason I bring this up is this. I've known people in the past, more than just a couple. I've known a few people in the past where they were someone I knew or someone that I knew because of similar associations, where people I have known who were believers in Christ and were Christians, and sometimes were actually very active in their faith, became atheists. And more than once, what I've seen from someone who transitioned from being a Christian to being an atheist, what I've seen more than once, is once they decide to make it public that they are now an atheist, they'll say this: I am happier now than I ever was when I was a Christian. Do you think David would feel that way? And whenever I read that, I think, I don't think that person really understood what it really meant to have faith in God, right? So again, there's really a need that when we think about God, thinking about God isn't just these expectations that God has and all these commands that we're failing at or always falling short and just constantly this heavy burden. What David expresses in this psalm is his faith in God is what relieves him of burdens in his life and sorrow in his life, not the other way around. And I want you to think, David was a king. So do you think David was ignorant of the fact that he had God-given responsibility, that there were tasks and things that he needed to obey? You know, David was not ignorant of those things. So again, so much of this comes down to the situation I'm mentioning. How do we see God? And do we really see him the right way? Do we see God the way that he leads us to see him? So we need to understand the blessing of really being forgiven. And we need to meditate on that and really dig deep into what that means. So in this psalm is unique. So this is a penitent psalm, meaning the psalmist is writing about his need for forgiveness. But this one is actually unique in that context. Most psalms where the psalmists are writing about their need for forgiveness and they're making an appeal to God for forgiveness, it's written in the context of them still being guilty. They may express their confidence that God will forgive them. So Psalm 51, the psalm David wrote in the context of his sin with Bathsheba, is like that. David is expressing his sorrow for his sin, his regret for his sin. He does express confidence that God will forgive him, but that's written in view of the fact that he hasn't been forgiven yet. It's something he's pursuing. This psalm is unique in that it's a reflection back on when he was guilty, but now he's forgiven. You know, one of the worst things that can happen in our faith is taking God's forgiveness for granted. You know, and how important it is to linger on his forgiveness and even on what he's done in forgiving us of our guilt. And I want to illustrate this way. So when I was in college, you know, I've mentioned many, many times that I was not in a good place in my faith when I was in college. But suffice it to say, in my college classes, I remember many times where I took a test in one of my college classes that really I wasn't properly prepared for. A lot of times, I think because of my lack of preparation, I thought I did pretty good, but then I got the grade back, got the test back, and I got a D or an F. And it convicted me, and I realized that this wasn't good and that something's got to change. But you know what I wouldn't do? I wouldn't take the time to really review what I actually did wrong. And I wouldn't take the time to really let it sink in why I bombed that test. And so what would happen is I would just get stuck in a cycle of, even though I would regret failing the test, ultimately because I wasn't lingering on the problem the right way, or really lingering on it because I want to fix the problem, I was just repeating the same problem again and again every time, and then acting surprised every time it happened. I think the reason why this psalm is so important is because this is the key to breaking the cycle of an attitude that does not appreciate the joy of God's forgiveness. What I mean is, if thinking about God always makes you feel guilty, if your relationship with God kind of always makes you feel bad, every time you come to an assembly, you just kind of think, I'm just going to get spanked again and be told how bad I am again. You just leave feeling downtrodden and guilty. If that's how you feel, this psalm is the key to fixing that problem. If there's repeated sin in your life, or there's something in your life that you know is against God, something that you are very aware is a sinful habit, and you just can't seem to break the habit, this psalm is the key to breaking out of that cycle, right? Because again, when you linger on the problem and the solution, when you take time to slow down and think about things the right way, it helps you escape vicious cycles. And then so, verse 2. So, you know, David is basking in the blessing of being forgiven. He's rejoicing in that. But there's a phrase at the end of verse 2 that I think is really worth considering here. In whose spirit there is no deceit. So if I had things on the board, this is what the board would say in verse 2. A deceived spirit is describing a person who either avoids or they become numb to the reality of their guilty status before God. Because the way that David deals with his sin here is like forgiveness. So the way that he deals with forgiveness, it's not just a subjective emotion. It's not just that he feels forgiven. It's objectively, he is forgiven. He knows that. That's how guilt works in this psalm too. Guilt is not just a feeling David has. Guilt is something that he recognizes is a status that he has before God, right? So again, a deceived spirit avoids or becomes numb to the reality of that condition of being guilty before God. Well, what does that look like? I think this would be helpful to think about. I can remember times in my life where I was guilty before God and I knew it. I knew I was either living in rebellion or I was hiding sin in my life that I really needed to make right and make known. And at particular times in my life, how I dealt with that guilt unproductively is I would distract myself. And that's a person who has a deceived spirit. And what I mean is, I was guilty, I knew I was guilty, it bothered me that I was guilty, but instead of slowing down and dealing with that, I would watch movies, I would play games, I would socialize with people, I would just do anything I could to distract myself with hobbies or whatever. You know, all things that aren't necessarily wrong things, but I was distracting myself and entertaining myself so that I wouldn't have to deal with my conscience, right? So a person may distract themselves as a way of avoiding taking responsibility for their guilt and really fixing that. That's a deceitful spirit. It could be through destroying evidence. So something that I've done that I think is very common, David did this in his sin with Bathsheba, is a way to avoid dealing with your guilt is you try to destroy the things that would get you found out by other people. And as long as people don't find out, well, then you're really safe, and now you don't have to really deal with your guilt, right? This could be something as simple as deleting your internet history because you're worried that someone who uses your phone or your laptop might see something that you're looking at that you don't want them to see. So again, if you just destroy the evidence, right, you get it, right? It could be distancing yourself from God, from his people. You know, you're avoiding reading the Bible because that makes you feel guilty. You're avoiding prayer because when you pray, you think about ways that you need to change, whatever. It also can be deflecting blame. So this is something that I think is very common and culturally is very acceptable. If you can convince yourself or hide behind something, that means you're the victim, then you're justified and you're excused from doing sinful things, right? if you lash out, if maybe in an argument you use profanities or lose your temper, well, you know what? It's really your fault anyway. You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have backed me into that corner. Or don't you know how hard things are for me? Don't you know how stressed out I am? So again, it can be a deflection of blame to say, I'm the victim, therefore I don't have to have any responsibility for what I did, because don't you know it's your fault or the fault of circumstance, right? All of that is a deceitful spirit, is not a way of following the pattern of the attitude we see with David here. Ultimately, what David does, he doesn't make excuses. He doesn't distract himself. He really focuses on the problem of his guilty condition, and he determines to just make that right and take responsibility for it. So that leads us to the rest of the psalm. Let's look at verses 3-7. And here we're looking at the condition of his guilt. And again, not something subjective, but objective. And what we're seeing here again is David is reflecting back on when he was guilty. So please take note of that, that David isn't in this psalm making the appeal. He's done with it. He's forgiven. But he's remembering when he wasn't forgiven, and he's reflecting on what he did to be forgiven. So, Psalm 32, starting in verse 3. When I kept silent about my sin, my bones wasted away. So take note, David here is saying, I was deceiving myself, right? It's not just that he was guilty. He knew he was guilty, but he was refusing to be open about it or confess it. When I kept silent about my sin, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not cover up. I said, I will confess my transgressions to Yahweh, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Therefore let every holy one pray to you at a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters, they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You guard me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. So what is David doing here? David is reflecting on the harm, the self-inflicted harm that was caused, number one, by his sin, and number two, by choosing to keep silent about it, which was not solving the problem. It was exasperating the problem. It was making things worse. And this is a critical thing that he reflects on. I want you to think about how David describes the problem of sin here. I think there can be a thought that is easy to have without realizing it or articulating it. And the thought is this: sin is a concept that really only exists in the Bible, or in the context of religion or Christianity. Outside of that, sin is kind of, it doesn't really exist. It's just the Bible talks about this thing, sin, and apparently you've got to fix that problem. And really, again, if you just don't believe in the Bible, I mean, sin isn't even a real thing, right? And I want to make this point in verse 3 and 4. To say sin only exists in the context of the Bible and Christianity is like to say cancer only exists in medical books. And cancer is a problem you really don't have to deal with unless you're in a hospital and you're around doctors. Other than that, cancer isn't really real. It's just something, again, in medical books or the context of a hospital. So you see how silly that is, right? Medical books train you to understand what cancer is. In a hospital, you're able to get diagnosed with and treated for cancer, right? So the Bible does deal with sin. And it deals with that so that we can understand something that does exist in the world that we inevitably will suffer from and have to deal with. But God deals with it so that we can diagnose and heal and recover from the problem of sin. So how does David describe this again in verse 3 and 4? He says his bones were wasting away, like he's suffering an infectious disease destroying him on the inside. He mentions that he was groaning all day long as this was happening, right? So it's not just a problem that exists when he chose to notice it. It wasn't a problem that came into being when he confessed his sin. This was there whether he chose to accept it or not. This was a problem that was destroying him, whether he acknowledged it or not. And he mentions that God's hand was heavy upon him day and night in verse 4. You know, there are some problems that won't be solved unless you slow down, stop what you're doing, you think about it, you let yourself feel it, and you begin to deal with it. He mentions his vitality was drained as in the fever heat of summer. This is something that I think, obviously, we experience in Savannah. But a particular way that I've thought about this is in Minnesota, where surprisingly it does get pretty hot in the summertime. There was a time where I worked inside of big UPS trucks in the summertime. And when you get inside of a UPS truck moving packages at a rapid pace in the summertime, I'm not kidding. Sometimes in those trucks, it would be like 130 degrees. So the company provides water and ice. They tell you you can only work for so long. You got to come out. You know, obviously, it's not worth getting heat stroke to move some packages, right, for a little bit of time. The idea, there's so only so long you can be in a situation like that before you have to stop. There's only so long you can work in a condition like that before you're risking your life at worst and at best injuring yourself because of overexerting yourself in that situation. So again, the idea is God is trying to get David to slow down. God is trying to get David to stop and to think about what's happening. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I want to illustrate this another way. There was a time in my family's life that I referenced passingly just a few minutes ago when we went bankrupt. And when we went bankrupt, my family, my dad, and a lot of us, we were not in a good spiritual condition. But bankruptcy forced us to move to a different area where everybody in my family was able to spiritually heal and change the way that we needed to, most especially my dad in that phase of his life. So bankruptcy, you could think bankruptcy is bad. You financially hit rock bottom. You've got to upheave your family and you've got to move somewhere else. You're potentially going to be homeless. It sounds so bad, but what that did, that bad thing, forced my family to slow down and forced my dad in particular to reflect on things that needed to be noticed and begin healing and changing. So what David is describing in verse 3 and 4 is a condition that is forcing him to face the problem. And better to face the problem than become numb to it. The worst thing that can happen is we become numb to the heavy conscience that we have when we know that we're guilty before God. Ultimately, what David is describing here is something that we should all be able to relate to. When you know that you're guilty, and you know that no matter what you do, you still have this conscience feeling eating away at you, and no matter what you do, you just can't seem to escape it. And what David is doing is just assigning reality to that feeling we have when we know that we are in the wrong and that we are guilty before God and have an issue in our life that we need to make right. So just checking my notes here. Something that I think is important to note with this is with David's expression here and how the way that he's describing this as if becoming physically very ill, being drained, being heavy, being burdened, being overwhelmed, it can seem like he's exaggerating or saying something that can be hard to relate to. I just want to make this point in something that we read during the Lord's Supper in Ephesians 2. Jesus suffered the reality of sin's condition. Jesus took on himself the condition that we should suffer when we're guilty. Ephesians 2 said, when we were guilty, when we were in the status of our transgressions and walking in that condition, it says we were dead in our transgressions and sins. And again, that's not theory. That's not just theological fluff. The idea is the problem of sin and its condition is much worse than what you can discover on your own, than what you can understand from your own feeling of guilt or emotions of guilt. The reality of sin is worse than you realize. But Jesus suffered that reality to save us from it. So again, what David is expressing here is a reality of sin's consequence. But then notice as well that through this, he expresses the blessing of confession. So in verse 5, this is like the parable of the prodigal son. Things get worse and worse until finally he comes to his senses and he acknowledged his sin. Have you ever thought about how important it is to reflect back on confession after confession? Because is confession easy? You know, that's not only something difficult with people, but I think what this psalm conveys is really if we understand how God feels about sin, although God is freely forgiving, and it indicates that in the psalm, if we understand the offense that sin is to God and the problem of sin more uniquely in relation to God, it should be more difficult to confess to God than to anyone else. And really, if we can work out confessing to God the right way, confessing to other people shouldn't be as difficult anymore. You know, think about this psalm even being written. After David went through the work of confessing, of accepting his sin, he wrote this for other people to read about and learn from, right? So again, he's trying to reflect on the benefit of confession. He was not making things better by hiding his sin. He was not making things better by ignoring the conviction of his conscience, by leaving sin unresolved in his life. And then number 3 here, a part of healing from sin is fixing my view of God. So verse 6 and 7, instead of running from God, instead of hiding from God, we need to run to God urgently. So in verse 7, you are my hiding place. In verse 3, he was hiding his sin from God, but now he's affirming, God, the right way of handling this wasn't keeping things away from you. It was running to you. It wasn't guarding myself from you. It was being guarded by you, right? So again, David isn't just trying to fix the problem of his sin, but also his broken view of God. I want to illustrate it this way. If you've done something against your spouse or someone in general, and you hide that, you don't deal with it, you leave it lingering, how long does it take before that begins impacting your view of that person, your attitude toward that person? So I've mentioned my parents a good number of times in this lesson, but one more illustration with my parents. When I was in a bad place, when I was in a sinful condition, when I was a teenager, and there were so many things that I was not dealing with, my parents, one of their greatest aspirations was keeping me accountable to God. That's what mattered the most to them. So when I was living in sin, do you think I had a very good view of my parents? Think I had a very respectful view toward my parents? I didn't, right? Because I knew that my parents, being around them, made me feel guilty. And so because there were unresolved problems that they were trying to hold me accountable to, ultimately this impacted my view of them. After resolving those things, I love my parents. I respect my parents. So again, the problem of sin isn't just a behavioral thing. It's not just something that we've got to fix by confessing. There's a problem in how sin endangers our ability to see God the right way. Verse 7. Again, is David scared of God? Does David just endlessly feel guilty as he thinks about God? No. He affirms in verse 5, you forgave me when I confessed my sin. And you are not someone for me to run away from or be scared of. You are someone who protects me, you guard me, you deliver me. And that leads to verse 8, where the psalm concludes with a series of exhortations, 8 through 11. I will give you insight and teach you in the way which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Do not be as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose harness are bit and bridle to control them. Otherwise, they will not come near you. Many are the sorrows of the wicked, but he who trusts in Yahweh, loving kindness shall surround him. Be glad in Yahweh and rejoice, you righteous ones, and shout for joy, all you who are upright in heart. So interestingly, in verse 8 and 9, David kind of gives this strange instruction where it's kind of hard to tell, is this David talking here or is this God himself speaking? I tend to think that because of the language of verse 8 particularly, it seems like this is God speaking in the psalm because he says, I will counsel you with my eye upon you. And I think the idea is this is God saying, this is about you and me, right? I see you, you're accountable to me. And so kind of think about where you are with me. So he says, I'm going to teach you and instruct you where you should go. I will counsel you, verse 9. Don't be like an animal that only responds to painful force against its will. You know, is verse 9 describing a working relationship? You know, can you imagine if someone asked Eva, how are things going with Bryant? She said, he's like a donkey that won't come near me unless it's got a bridle in its mouth. It has to be pulled in. I mean, obviously that's not talking about a healthy or good relationship, right? The idea expressed in the psalm is God is not going to force us to come near him. And really verse 3 and 4, as difficult as that condition sounds, what God is trying to do is work with David's will, not against David's will. That God is trying to work with our will, and what God was doing is giving David a taste of where he was going. You know, we should not want to live in separation with God, because that only involves the consequence of eternal torment. So to realize how bad things are getting because of guilt and make that right is a blessing. So again, God is warning us, choose to make things right when there's opportunity. Don't be like an animal that has to be forced to come near you. Otherwise, it's not going to care. It's not going to think about it. It has no understanding. The idea is these are concepts we have to be deliberate to think about and to meditate on and to act on. God will not work against our will. But if we want to be separated from God, if that's what we want, the worst thing that can happen to us is for God to allow us that freedom to live separate from him and to become numb to it. Better to be sensitive to that. Better to suffer the issue of a convicted conscience and make that right than live callous to it. And then forgiveness puts everything in perspective. So verse 10. It's interesting that David says, many are the sorrows of the wicked. I want to illustrate this with a parable Jesus taught in Luke chapter 16. There was a man named Lazarus whose life seemed problematic, grievous. He was laid at this rich man's gate every day and was so poor that he didn't seem to have proper clothing or care, and so the dogs would come and lick his sores at the rich man's gate. But inside that gate, there was a rich man living joyously in splendor every day. Now, the problem with this man living in joyous splendor is we find out he was living a life separate from God. He had unresolved sin in his life that he was completely numb to. So they both died. The poor man was taken to Abraham for comfort. The rich man was... He opened up his eyes in torment. So the psalm says, many are the sorrows of the wicked. How should we understand that? Based on Luke 16 and so many areas in Scripture, you know, we may not see those who leave unresolved sin in their life suffering sorrow right now. But how should we view the wicked who, even if they seem prosperous, successful, joyful, carefree, but they're living in separation from God. They have unresolved sin in their life. Is that something that we should be envious of? Or something to pity and stay away from? Again, the worst thing that can happen is to become numb to the reality of being separated from God. The problem of sin is not theoretical. It's not an issue that only exists in the Bible or in the context of believers assembling together. God is trying to make something known to us that we will have to face at some point inevitably. So in verse 10 and verse 11, the latter part of verse 10, the encouragement is to be glad in the Lord. And again, this is a decision that the psalm is encouraging, verse 11. Be glad, number one. Rejoice, number two. And shout for joy in the Lord, number three. We need to build joy in a forgiven condition. You know, obviously there's a need to understand we need to obey the Lord. We want to grow. We should want to grow. We should be aware of ways we can grow. There's going to be things that we're not doing that we want to be more involved in. But again, to fundamentally build and dig deep in a sense of joy and gladness in the fact that when God forgives, he completely forgives. God does not partially forgive. We can have confidence in God's forgiveness. And again, the encouragement is we need to be deliberate to have more joy and gladness in the reality of God's forgiveness. So by invitation, I want to ask, where are you? Are you in a place this morning where, like David said, you need to seek the Lord at a time when he may be found? Maybe you're here, and there is something in your life where when you hear a lesson like this about a convicted and guilty conscience, trying to ignore that, that something is pulled to the surface, and you're aware something needs to be made right, and you've been neglecting to deal with it the right way. Maybe that's where you're at. I would encourage you, make that right this morning. Or maybe you're here this morning, and you just need to rejoice more and be more glad in the fact that you are forgiven. And have more confidence in the fact that when God forgives you, you are in a forgiven status. And that's something to reflect on and embrace. Let's pray on these things, and then we'll extend a final invitation.